we've learned now through other research on milking equipment and the liner function that we're creating congestion in the end of the teat during that period of low milk flow. The street canal is getting narrow because of the blood congestion in the end of the teat. So we're not getting all the milk out of the gland. She comes in with X number of pounds. We're never going to get that milk, that gland completely empty. Those quarters never completely empty out.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Your partner for extra animal performance, Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Feed solutions that surpass expectations. Learn more about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/feed. That's schooler.com/feed. Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Diamond V, because animal health deserves a healthier approach. Trow Nutrition, North America. Everything we do is driven by passion and backed by science.
Hello, welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show brought to you by WiseNetics. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University, and today honored to welcome a colleague of mine to the show, Dr. Roger Thompson. Roger, thanks for joining today.
My pleasure to be here, Barry. Thanks for inviting me.
So I always like to hear people's backstories. I'm sure you were born in a barn or something, but how did you decide to become a dairy veterinarian?
I was born in a barn. Next county south here in southern Michigan. Grew up on a small mixed animal farm. Got the bug to want to be a veterinarian 10 or 12 years old. Loved cows the whole time. That was my problem. So came up to Michigan State as a junior out of community college. Scared to death as a farm boy coming up here. Didn't think I'd ever get into vet school. Got lucky and got in and graduated from Michigan State Veterinary School in 1979. So, yes. Went into practice in Ohio for 3 years. My first practice in Orrville, Ohio. Then I got the kind of the itch to want to get back near family. So came back and instead of growing my home in Jackson, went down I-94 to Battle Creek, kind of similar towns. And got into a practice there, and then by the late 80s, so I hadn't been out quite 10 years, I got the harebrained idea to start my own practice, and all cattle, all dairy, and never looked back from there. Grew it from myself as a solo to a four-person practice that I sold in 2017. And so all dairy all the time.
And somewhere in there, I know you sort of expanded from I don't know if this is a fair characterization, but you were doing kind of standard dairy practice.
True.
And then you expanded and added sort of consulting on milk quality. Talk me through how that developed or evolved.
So there came a point after, 10 or 15 years on practice and you start getting the hang of everything. I wasn't good at anything, but I kind of did a lot of stuff.
Uh-huh.
But I started dawning on me, I really wasn't good at anything. I was a good generalist. I helped feed a lot of cows, the normal dairy practice regimen that you would do. Yeah. And I had a client over in the Grand Rapids area that approached me one day after her check and said, I've got some mastitis problems. Do you know anything about mastitis milk quality? And what I learned in school was you could put in a thimble, wasn't a lot, but again, I thought, well, a little bit. I said, let's talk about it. And so I went into the parlor and watched a little bit and went back and found the owner and good friends with the owner and had him as a client for a long time.
Uh-huh.
I said, I think, your cow's a little dirty and might, might be preppy shoes that could be improved. And he immediately said, no, that's not it. And I mean, what? He said, it's the equipment, milking equipment. I said, how do you know? I just know. And I said, have you had the dealer out? Yeah, he was out a couple weeks ago. And what'd they say? They said everything's fine. And I don't believe them. Honest to goodness. He said, I read in my face. I said, oh my goodness. So he's working with the equipment dealer. I don't believe him. And at that point, I said, I can't help you with that. I don't know how to evaluate a system. I don't know anything about milking systems. So I literally drove out the driveway, kind of crestfallen my first attempt at doing some advising, some consulting on milk quality just crash and burn. I didn't help a bit. So it kept bugging me. And a few months later, I at the ABP short course I took on milk quality.
Uh-huh.
Mentors there, talked on how to check milking systems. So I bought a Tri-Scan, came back and was scared to death to use it. So I had to, in the middle of practice, start working on getting specialized in something.
Yep.
And milk quality just caught my interest. 2 years later, I was finally comfortable enough and able enough to go to the client that I'd still been palpating for 2 years.
Okay.
And said, hey, can I check your system now? I think I know how to do it. And I did. And I said, your equipment is testing out within standards of all the NMC stuff. It must be something else. And he said, okay, what do you think it is? I said, I think you're milking dirty cows. And he said, oh, okay. Well, tell me what I should do. So, that day, 2 years later, I drove out feeling kind of satisfied. I think I helped him, but it took a
heck of a long time. Just by crossing something off the list.
Huh? It took forever to really help it. That was the beginning. That was my first troubleshooting problem case that it took like 24 months to help. And I've gotten faster now. But it just became something that meshed for me. And it's not only troubleshooting the milk quality and milking clean cows and the prep, that's all critical. But the novelty of the system itself and analyzing the system, that worked for me, just my mind and what I like to do, and I'm kind of hands-on. And so from there, and that was over 20 years ago when this story happened. And I just got more involved, went to meetings, trained more, started doing more things. And fast forward to today now, I kind of do it full time. And I sold my practice, but I came up here to teach, but I'm still doing consulting work. And it's always going to be milk quality machine system focused, because that became a joy to do.
Yeah.
Once you get good at it, instead of being a fear, it's a joy. And so I just love going to barns I've never been to. It's almost like a giddy feeling of, what am I going to see today?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's usually, I'm never let down that I find stuff that's going on that can be better for the cows. This is all about what's best for the cow. And so I like it. And that's how I got niched as a veterinarian doing milk quality stuff and system checks.
Pretty neat.
So kind of goofy.
Elevate animal performance with Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition, your trusted ally in excellence. Their high-quality feed ingredients like coated nutrients and fat powders provide ruminants with extra energy, boosting health, productivity, and cost efficiency. Unleash your herd's potential with Berg & Schmidt.
And you've been teaching at Michigan State for about 8 years now?
Yeah.
And so tell me just a little bit about that. What kind of students are you teaching?
Yeah, I was minding my own business. I'd sold my practice. I was going to just ride off in the sunset and do consulting stuff. And then a colleague downstairs, Dr. Domek, that's been here forever teaching animal science courses, dairy courses, called me. He had me coming in even when I was still in practice, maybe once a year, twice a year, I'd do a little lecture guest thing. And he must have saw something that I didn't see in it, but he said, we could use some help here, lost a faculty member. And I said, no. And he emailed me a few days or weeks later, you sure you want to do it? No. I kept saying no. And I finally said, all right, what do I have to do? Well, you got to come up and interview. And I did. One thing led to another. So it's been very satisfying and rewarding. And I've gotten a joy to be here. And so I'm teaching production medicine courses, dairy science courses. And I got a joint appointment now with the vet school. So once they find you, I figured out these universities. Once they find you're there, all of a sudden your plate starts getting fuller and fuller.
Yeah.
And then you put sideboards on like a grain wagon, and then they put more and more. You put another row of sideboards on your grain wagon, and then they put more and more. And so you don't run out of things to do, but it's a joy. I like teaching. I like working with the students. Their enthusiasm keeps me young. I think keeps all of us young. And I get to work with colleagues like yourself and others.
Yeah. Oh.
And I've had to learn a lot. I mean, just being a dairy veterinarian, I thought I knew enough, but I didn't know enough to really teach. That's when you get exposed, when you have to teach.
That is true.
So I'm a better consultant. I really believe I've got more breadth of information to bring because I have to teach it. So it's made me better. That's humbling to say, but it's good.
That's awesome.
So I'm liking it a lot.
Yeah, you've had a big impact here, and like the Dairy Challenge work that you do takes a lot of time. And
that's fun.
It's very impactful.
That's fun. Yep, love doing that.
All right, we better get in some meat here for this podcast so people can actually learn something instead of just your funny stories. So
okay.
Yeah, I know one of your big focus areas in milk quality consulting is prep preparation of the cow and the udder, right? Sure. Talk me through that, because I think that's something where there used to be like everybody followed kind of the same rules, and that's kind of gone to the wayside a little bit, partly with growing pressure to move cows through parlors, right?
Yeah. So I don't think anybody would deny the fact that the U.S. dairy industry, and of course the global industry follows what the U.S. does, but U.S. dairy industry has been on a steady march for decades. It's not just recent. Bigger, faster.
Yep.
And certainly from 50 cows in a stanchion barn to maybe a parlor and 250 cows in freestalls, that was monumental move there, but that happened 50 years ago, 40 years ago. And so now we're up to bigger, faster parlors, parallels instead of herringbones to make them shorter, rotaries instead of parallels that we can milk more cows per hour. None of these advancements are wrong. There's nothing about that. But in the competitive nature that the dairy industry is, and we have to acknowledge that in the old days, neighbors were neighbors, and you know, you milk cows, I milk cows, and we'd help each other, and you didn't feel like you were competing against a neighbor. We all hung together so we could build fence together and maybe make crops together. Today, okay, we've got these big groups in the U.S., and they are absolutely very aware that they're competing with everybody else.
Yeah.
So that's okay. Makes everybody better. But what the result to me is that bigger, faster has turned into, we're really going incredibly fast now. I don't mind the size necessarily, as long as we make sure we're not overstressing cows or large groups and some of those facts that I'm still curious if we're doing problems that way with big groups. But in the parlor, we're pushing to, and I would submit we push beyond the limit of what the cow's physiology is hardwired to accept when it comes to getting a good harvest of milk. I had a friend say this years ago, and I saw I stole it completely from a friend. The cow has to fully participate in the milk harvest process. She has to participate. The letdown is a big part of it, right? She's got to give us our milk, because we can't just suck it out with a giant vacuum sweeper. So we're there on a lot of these big rotaries and even big parallels where the guys are having to go faster and faster, or the rotaries are going faster. So the mantra today is, I need a rotary, a big rotary that spins at 4 seconds a stall. If I don't, I'm nothing. I mean, there's a real competition out there. Little did I know that dairymen have really quite big egos. But that's okay. They're businessmen and businesswomen, and they have to compete. But the big fast rotaries are the badge of success at this point. Mm-hmm. And so 72 stalls, 80 stalls, that's felt like the biggest you'd ever see, but that was 20 years ago.
Yep.
And now we're doing the 100s, the 106s, the 110s, the 120s. Legend is that there's a 140 coming out. Somebody's talking about on paper building a 180 that would have two exits and entry points. So you'd only do a half a spin on it. So you'd have 90 stalls that you would actually have cows milking on, and they'd get in at point zero, and at 180 degrees, they'd exit. You've got the same thing going the other way. So you could bring two holding pens in either side of this big 180 and be milking two groups on the same rotary. Theoretically, they'd look at each other across the rotary, but wow, they would go back to different pens. That's just being talked about. Nobody's built that yet, but that's where we're at. The problem is, how fast can we spin these rotaries, and what's best for the cow for her letdown, or when does it stop? Now, there are some rotaries that are reportedly under 4 seconds a stall now.
Yep.
3.6 seconds a stall. We may have to put Velcro on the bottom of cows' feet to keep them on their feet, to keep them on the rotary, because it's that ride at the county fair where you just spin off. But the physiology hasn't changed, and we have to have a prep time, we have to have lag time, we have to have pre-dip contact time to get a good harvest. And we're not getting that done too many times these days. So I'm not happy with that, if I can be an advocate for what's best for the cow.
Probably many people at one point or another have heard that sort of lecture about here's how milk letdown occurs, but give us a Cliff Notes version of that. So like what's it in your mind for the cow or for optimal milk harvest? What's the optimal timing of these different steps to pre-harvest?
Physical touch. We've got to have physical touch to get the neural hormonal reaction happening. That's the milk letdown reflex. Neural means touching teeth. Hormonal is oxytocin coming out of the posterior pituitary. So for that to happen, we got to touch the teeth.
Yep.
In nature, the calf is the stimulator.
Yep.
And you watch a calf come up and muzzle, you know, mess around with the gland, butt it with their head.
Yep.
That's the stimulator. So what do we do as humans? We've got to mimic that at some point. So what counts as something stimulatory? We've determined that putting the pre-dip on doesn't really give a lot of tactile stimulation. So that doesn't count. Whether we spray, cup,
okay,
those kinds of methods to get liquid on, you shouldn't really feel that. You do a power brush, which is putting some sanitizers on the prep brushes. Okay, she feels that.
Yep.
So the real stimulators are force stripping,
yep,
which is a wonderful stimulator for letdown, and it's the only way we can find abnormal milk.
Yep.
How do you find mastitis? Well, you look at the abnormal milk. If I'm not force stripping, how do I find mastitis? You don't. You don't. You find it on the filter sock is where you find it.
Right.
But so stripping, the brush, active brush systems, towel wipe, we want to get the teeth clean. So those physical contacts really are stimulators. That's going to get the neural message going. We need a minimum of 8 seconds. And I've done enough data, hundreds and hundreds of parlors with analysis. And when we get under 8 seconds of stimulation, and that's total. So if I strip and wipe, if I wipe and strip, if I brush and wipe, any things that are stimulatory, we can add those together. So
okay,
plus them together, and I need 8 seconds total.
Okay.
10 is better, 12 is better, 15 would be fantastic. Nobody does it, we don't have that much time, but we'll back up. Can I get to 8 to 10 seconds total? So okay, can I four strip, you know, three tugs on each teat, should be 4 or 5 seconds. Can I come in the towel and wipe 4 or 5 seconds? Bing, I'm gonna get adequate stimulation.
Okay.
And then I need the lag or latency period. That's the time for the oxytocin to get the mammary gland and get the myoepithelial cells to squeeze, get the milk from the glandular part down in the cisternal part. Because free milk that's in the bottom of the gland, that's in the teeth and gland cistern, that's called free milk. That's removable without letdown. So yep, when I put a unit on and I got milk in my claw, where'd that come from? That's the free milk that's in the glandular part, in the cisternal part, excuse me.
Yep.
Glandular milk, that doesn't come out without oxytocin. So that's where you get the double letdown. You get milk in the claw, and then if you watch for 30 seconds and all of a sudden the claw is empty for a little bit, you say, what happened? That was free milk that was removed. Now we're waiting for the glandular milk to come.
Yep.
If we do nothing but just attach a unit, we will eventually get a letdown. 60 to 90 to 120 seconds. She'll eventually get let down because attaching the unit is also stimulatory.
Yeah.
It's the calf sucking. And when I first learned all this stuff many, many years ago, didn't understand that. So read papers from Dr. Bruckmeier out of Switzerland and talked with others. And all of a sudden, I had a kind of real epiphany. Okay, I get it now. The physiology's sort of complicated, but not. And we got to work with her because we're not going to suck out the glandular milk. Nope.
Yep.
So we got that. And the lag time needs to be 90 seconds is what we preach for that latency or lag period from when we got all the stimulation done, start the stopwatch, and 90 seconds later, we can attach humans. When is too long? About 3 minutes, about 180 seconds from getting the stimulation done. If we wait beyond that, we start losing that initial effect of oxytocin.
Okay.
Because remember, once we attach the unit, in about 60 to 90 seconds, what do we get? Another wave of oxytocin.
Yeah.
And that continues until we detach. So basically, the prep procedure is building a bridge from first attach to the letdown from the cow, the unit being on the cow.
Okay.
And then we don't run out of oxytocin the rest of the milking bath, whether it's 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes.
Yep.
We still got oxytocin coming. And that wasn't how I learned it years ago, but that's what Bruckmeier's paper really clarified when I read that years ago.
Gotcha. And so when you go assess parlors, are you specifically looking for how quick milk letdown occurs after attachment?
Yeah, I've got some equipment, some vacuum measuring equipment that I always put on that will get an analysis of each milking event, each cow's milking event. And with this new equipment, we can do a very simple analysis on how is that prep affecting her. Did we get good milk flow from the moment attachment made to when the unit came off, or did we have milk flow, no milk flow, milk flow again, i.e. the bimodal or biphasic, the same words, just we're throwing them around recklessly. But we get the double let down and we can count those. And so on these big rotaries, I can do an estimate on percentage of bimodals based on the data I get. And a lot of farms are with having half of the herd with bimodal starts for the milking event, 60 to 70%. My personal record was a big rotary someplace in the US where they were just attaching units. And they were at 98% of all the milking events started with a bimodal startup.
Okay.
Is that a problem? You know, what is the risk of that? You could say, no big deal, we're getting the milk out. But we've learned now through other research on milking equipment and the liner function that we're creating congestion in the end of the teat during that period of low milk flow. The street canal is getting narrow because of the blood congestion at the end of the teat. So we're not getting all the milk out of the gland. She comes in with X number of pounds. We're never going to get that milk, that gland completely empty. Those quarters never completely empty out.
Okay.
It's about 7% of the milk called residual milk that stays in the gland that is only removable by endogenous oxytocin.
Yep.
Exogenous oxytocin.
Shot. Injections, yeah.
Injection of oxytocin. Otherwise, it stays in there and goes back. But if we start with a bimodal prep, a bimodal milking event, we start with that, we tend to not get all the milk out.
Okay.
And depending on the length of the delayed ejection, 30, 60, 90 seconds, however long it is, the longer it is, the more shrinkage we get on the street canal from congestion and the less milk we harvest. It can be up to maybe 6 or 7 pounds that we literally don't get out of all functional quarters that she takes back to the pen. Is that a problem? You could say, well, we'll get it the next time she comes in, which is true. It's
yep.
there available. But over time, if she has bimodal event visit after visit, unintentionally, we're starting to let back pressure build up in the gland.
Yep.
The apocrine-paracrine system that is all about what generates the synthesis of milk in the gland starts getting that reverse checking on synthesis going on. Basically, we're slowly drying her up a little bit.
Yep.
Over day after day, week after week, if we're bimodal milking over time after time. A study from Dr. Erskine and Cornell, Matthias Weiland at Cornell's redone this same data. We might be leaving the 7 pounds in, but probably 2, 3, 4 pounds is a very common amount if we've got a lot of biphasics in a herd that
okay.
we're sending back to the pen. And eventually that milk is just not harvestable. So it's faster and faster. It may seem like we're milking more cows, but what about efficiency and the marginal milk we're leaving in there, right? That's what Mike Overton has always talked about when it comes to the marginal milk. Can I get another pound or two out of that cow when she comes in to get milked?
Yep.
That doesn't cost me anything. We've already paid for it in TMR intake.
Yep.
What if I got that in the bulk tank and I got into a truck and left? And a pound per day on 100 cows, you could yawn at, but a pound per day on 5,000, now I have your attention.
Yeah.
Now I have your attention.
And I think, you know, certainly parlor efficiency is a part of the equation to profitable dairying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it is a huge capital investment. It's probably half of your infrastructure investment. But on a running basis, my math would say typically if you stretch that investment over 15 years, it's probably making up 10% of your cost of production. So I see so many people focusing all their efforts on optimizing that 10%.
Yes.
And I'm a nutritionist. Okay. But 55% of your input costs are feed.
Feed.
And if you're not optimizing that because you want to make your parlor run faster, I think that's maybe in the long run not the best decision. What do you think?
Agree completely. So when we teach the kids in this dairy challenge program and we're always trying to figure out how to find another pound of milk for a
yeah.
farm we visit, to improve profitability.
Yep.
And we teach them, and you have to pay for that. So you got to add a little more dry matter intake to pay for that pound. A pound of dry matter intake
right.
should be 2.5 pounds of additional milk
yep.
production under a normal
marginal
scenario.
Yep.
right? So with this bimodal thing, we've already paid for that.
Yep.
They came in and they ate X amounts of pound. They brought that milk in. And if we leave a couple of pounds, it goes back to the pen. That's just loss opportunity. Or the other way is if we get another pound out, I don't have to pay for that with a third of a pound of dry matter intake more.
Yep.
We already paid for that.
Yep.
So when we do the analysis, that's almost, I hate to use the word pure profit, but that's money in or out of your pocket. It's that profound.
It just costs you that 15 seconds of labor.
Ding, ding, ding. Second. Right. So that's why.
Yeah.
We're having a lot of fun with it. We're trying to get the word out.
Yep.
And we're continuing to confirm that this is real, that we're leaving milk in these glands when our prep is not exactly what the cow needs.
Yeah.
We're not letting her fully participate.
Biologically, I wonder if that sort of residual stretch effect isn't much more impactful, like in the first 4 weeks of lactation. Have you guys looked specifically at that kind of question?
We did get some data from a big group of dairies out in the Midwest that are milking 2x.
Oh, okay. Yep. So the impact should be greater there.
And the data would say that the first 100 days, 150 days or less in milk, they definitely were seeing lost production once they got over peak and they were down the lactation graph a little bit for the tail end cows, middle to late lactation cows. They weren't seeing that kind of extra return on that with the bimodal letdowns. But their big rotaries are spinning fast and they are allowing a lot of biphasics to happen. Mm-hmm. And they're leaving some milk on the table, especially early in lactation. So, it's not published, but that was what they found in a farm-based study, exactly what you thought.
Gotcha. So if you were going to build a dairy today, obviously you have to try to make it profitable. What kind of parlor would you put in?
If I was going to milk a couple thousand cows, I could talk myself into a nice parallel.
Okay.
The parallels require attention to detail for training of the milkers. I call it the ballet that the milkers have to do in a traditional parallel or herringbone. And that requires attention to detail and management and training. So to get them staying steady in the prep and the rhythm of the parallel, it takes steady attention and encouragement from a parlor manager or an owner. And that's where you could say, well, I just want to put a rotary in because I just put a mat down on the floor and I say, you stand here and you do this. And a few stalls over, you stand there and do that. And then, every group will rotate you so you can change your task. But it's like working at a car plant. I'm going to put a nut on a bolt over and over again. Whereas a parallel, you've got all these steps you may do in a territory or some pattern like that. But I still love a nice parallel with a subway underneath of it for smaller groups of cows. But I understand as the economies of scale are encouraging larger operations, the rotaries on a per head per hour basis or pounds per hour basis, they are the champions. They are the champions. But that said, all we got to do is accept we got to start looking at our numbers to say, what if I slow my rotary down a couple seconds and I'm able to get enough stim time there that I can get a good letdown? And then I get a good harvest on the rotaries. The speed is not the problem. It's we now are asking humans to do something that's impossible because the cow goes by me in 4 seconds. And I need 8 seconds of something to get a letdown.
Yep.
And so that's where to me, the war is right now. Can we get good prep on a rotary? Absolutely. Can we do it at 3 seconds? Well, you got to put another person in there. And now my efficiency, my pounds per man hour starts to look different because now I got to put 4 or 5 people in there on the prep because my rotary is spinning wonderfully fast. And
how does that math work then?
So where's my economy look there?
Yeah.
And the person, the individual in the middle of all this discussion is the cow. And she's either treated the best we know how, or she gets victimized a little bit. And that's where I'm struggling with the really fast spinning rotaries. We're leaving stuff on the table. And I can't say in good conscience that's what's best for the cow in those scenarios. her physiology is hardwired.
Yep.
You can do anything you want to her, and she's going to work at a certain same speed.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Asepsis, an ounce of prevention. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, Smacks Tech future-proofs your dairy operation. Hi-D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status to deliver higher milk yield and carcass efficiency. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Volac, unlocking ruminant potential through nutritional solutions for a sustainable future. Maximize profitability and herd health with early detection in animal health, reproduction, and feeding. The most advanced bolus technology and professional support from agricultural experts make this possible with SmacksTech, the health management system that future-proofs your dairy operation.
Well, we're going to run out of time quickly here, so I got to dig into these three big questions we ask everybody.
Well, I
hope you've done your homework.
I did. Yeah.
So, go ahead.
My favorite dairy books, dairy-related books, because that I'm such a goofball to just want to do one thing. So, I live and die with the NMC procedures for evaluating vacuum levels and airflow in milking systems. It's really the NMC airflow analysis book that is based on ISO standards. So,
okay,
the ISO organization establishes all these different systems, and so the NMC book has really been aligned since 2012 to mirror that one. So I carry those in my backpack all the time and showing people, and I'm referring to them for my own benefit. And
then there's out on the beach.
Yep. You see, I don't have a life. So yeah, I sit on the beach and read the book. Then there's a newer one out, Machine Milking Volume 1 by Dr. Graham Mean and Dr. Doug Reinemann. They are a couple equipment gurus that have really pioneered a lot of our knowledge we use today. And it's a really wonderful in-depth book, so I've got that one dog-eared. And then a new one that came out, GEA, Milking Intelligence, it's called, an illustrated guide to optimal cow milking by Dr. Norm Schuring. Mm-hmm. Norm was a big exec at GEA, Surge, then Westphalia, then GEA for a long time. I think he's retired now, but it's got great pictures in it, a lot of good drawings and things. So it's a really good picture about all aspects of harvesting milk and cow comfort and cow management and things all in one big book. And so you can get those from GEA people if you want to get one or buy one.
Nice.
Paper books outside of ag. So I'll start with the Bible. It's a favorite book of mine and helps guide me in all I'm trying to do. And then I like all the leadership books from John Maxwell. I've read those for years. And yep. There isn't a one I haven't picked up that I haven't benefited from and learned from. And then Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book. Some of the books of his I'm not intrigued with, but his one on outliers, where he talked about famous people and what they had to do to become successful. And I don't know, it just really resonated with me. So it really was impacted by that one. And then what sets apart successful dairy professionals from the crowd is how I kind of phrased it.
Uh-huh.
So for me, it's passion.
Yep.
And what do you have to be passionate about? Well, get good at something, I like to say. So I'm passionate about cows. I'm passionate about the dairy products we make from the cow and how it impacts human diet, how important it is for us in the U.S., but globally, how important it is. And then personal development, get really good at something. And if you do, you'll have, a lot of professional satisfaction. At least that's what I found.
Yep.
And people are going to find your phone number and start calling you if you get really good at something. Because customers, clients, farmers, they want somebody to come help them, but they also like somebody that's really passionate about
absolutely
what you're there instead of, yeah, I think you got some guy, I think your partner's okay. Yeah. I mean, it's not wrong. You could be the smartest person in the room, but they want somebody that's really fired up about it. So
if you're not excited about what you have to share, why would anyone else, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The dairy industry is demanding excellence from all of us. So,
yep.
I mean, I couldn't come and talk anything about nutrition. I try to study it to know about things, but I've had to narrow down my scope. I'm right on the cusp of knowing everything about nothing. I mean, right there. But that's what it takes to really bring something to the table, because these big producers, they've got people there all the time. And if they call you in and you're the ninth guy that's been there, you know, you think, what am I going to see?
Absolutely. Yeah.
A little daunting. And I know you're doing that too. And when you come out and consult and you get out of the country, the same thing. It's, we had everybody there. So what am I going to see?
Yeah. Well, you've proven that you can see things. You're a true outlier.
It's an honor. That's what took me to that world.
Yeah.
I got 10,000 hours in.
Yeah, I bet you do. No doubt. Well, again, Dr. Roger Thompson, thanks so much for being on the show today. It's been a fun conversation, as always.
Thank you, Barry. It's been a pleasure to be here.
So this has been another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. If you haven't subscribed yet, make sure you hit that button so you don't miss the next episode. And we'll see you next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.